Amen. All right, we are in Acts chapter 16. Somebody did ask if we will have the test on Friday, and oh yeah, we'll get there plenty of time. So you definitely will have a test on Friday. Just to let you know, I am bound and determined. So we left Paul and Silas in prison over the weekend, and now we're actually going to see how they get set free, which is pretty unique. It's unique in the sense of it's not like any other release from prisons in the book of Acts. Because what you have is a miraculous event that's really not capitalized on, which is pretty strange. With Peter, you know, you saw kind of the sleepwalking situation where he finds himself out in the road and he's like, what's happening? And the angel leaves and he's like, oh man, I guess this is real. And that's not really what we have happening here in Acts chapter 16. You have a miracle that occurs, and they basically don't capitalize on it, and that leads to their release, which is pretty strange. But Paul and Silas are in prison. Where are they in prison at? Cheat, if you have to. It's right in front of you. Philippi. Absolutely, Philippi. Philippi, where the church was established, and who was the key leader? A woman by the name of Lydia. Lydia, who is a seller of purple clothing. Paul and Silas, though, were put into prison because, as normally happens, they caused some trouble with the gospel. This, though, in particular, had to do with what? Usually it's the Jews that come and attack them. But in Philippi, it's a little bit different. Who is upset with them in Philippi? What's that?
Pagans.
Yeah, pagans. For what reason? Yeah. They destroyed their business by casting a demon out of a little girl. And that ticked them off. They basically bring them before, in verse 19, they dragged them to the marketplace to face the authorities. Verse 20, they brought them before the magistrates and said, these men are Jews and are throwing our city into an uproar by advocating customs unlawful for us Romans to accept to practice. Accept or practice. And that was semi-accurate. That's not really why they were upset. It's not like they were trying to protect the customs of the Romans, and that's why they're mad at them. They're mad at them because they were losing money. But this is what would really get them in trouble with the Roman, with the right authorities. And we'll see that same tactic happening in Thessalonica, but with the Jews. Because ultimately, you only have so much power in the Roman Empire. If you have a problem with someone in the Roman Empire, you can't take care of it yourself. You can't just beat them, or you can't, you know, kill them or anything like that. It's not like they were just barbarians. If you wanted somebody to experience some sort of punishment, you had to have the right authorities do it. And that's what's happening here. They know they themselves can't recuperate the money that they have lost. So what they're doing is they're bringing them before the right authorities, accusing them of something that's only tangentially related to really what you're worried about. But as a result, you'll get the desired outcome that you're looking for. And that's what they're doing. Verse 22, the crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten. After they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. You got to remember, the flogging wasn't just a mild beating just to send a message. If flogging, they wouldn't want to kill the person when they were flogging them. But they would want the person to wish they were dead. That's the idea. You're going to send a very clear political, emotional, physical, spiritual message. You're not the one in control. And if you cause problems in our region, you will face the wrath of our authorities. So they flog them. They beat them. And then they say, hey, guard, you better keep him quite carefully, both these thugs. Verse 24. Upon receiving such orders, he put them in the inner cell and fastened their feet in the stocks. He made sure they were very, very safe and secure. The inner cell, which would have been, you have to picture the jails back then are a little bit different than ours. Okay? The jails back then wouldn't have had, you know, a personal toilet for every cell. Let that sink in for a minute. It would have been urine laden. It would have been, animals would have been allowed in. If, you know, rats and things of that nature they'd be feeding on. The people that were literally rotting in the places they were at. So it's not a pleasant place to be. And if you're in the inner cell, that means that you're going to be around the worst of the worst. Because like solitary confinement in our own prisons, you keep the ones that are worst in those areas. And that's where Paul and Silas are thrown into the inner cell to make sure that they don't get out. Because if they do get out, the jailer is responsible. He will have to take whatever punishment was promised to them. So if his life's on the line, he's going to do whatever it takes to make sure that they are in a position where they're not getting out. Similar to Peter, but a bit different. Verse 25, about midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God. Just imagine that for a minute. Now they're laying in their urine-laden cell next to the worst of the worst. And they're just provoked to sing. They just can't help themselves. There is a principle here where it's like, man, what are you complaining about? You know? It is so easy to complain from a position of privilege. It's really difficult to complain whenever you have nothing. And they have more to complain about than what we do, and yet they don't. And I find that to be a very consistent thing. When I'm talking to people, the most greedy people I meet are not the people on the streets a lot. I'm not saying there aren't some people that are greedy that are out there. A lot of times, they're the most thankful. Those of us that have so much, we just complain about everything. Oh, my battery died on my iPad, you know. Oh, no. Can I make it? You know, or our phone gets erased and we almost fly off the handle at everybody around us because we're so upset. Really? Really? That's what we're going to be complaining about? If that's the attitude we have, our churches are going to be a mess. And so are our families. So are all of our relationships. Because a lot of times we complain because we're selfish. And not because we really have something to complain about. So until you're laid in the inner cell, in your own urine, falsely being accused of something you weren't even totally guilty of, I don't want to hear you really complaining. And I don't even think that in that moment you would be complaining if you went into it with the right heart. See, one of the things we got to realize is we're in training right now for the moments that really matter. And if right now you treat yourself as a spoiled little brat, whenever difficult things come along, that's how you'll react. But man, if you discipline yourselves in these small moments, whenever not much, in a sense to be content where you're at, to be thankful for everything you have in every moment, to be pure and to be walking with the Lord, whenever the difficult moments come, you'll be ready to go. But a lot of times it's when the difficult moments come that we try to start finding our armor and weapons for the war. That doesn't make any sense at all. It's not like the soldiers, even in our wars today, that they very first learn how to fight whenever they land on the enemy's soil. All right, now it's time to learn how to fight. Where's the weapons? You got to find them. No, they're trained beforehand. But most of us don't even realize there's a war going on outside of us, so we're not training at all. So we develop a theology and we develop a system around us that serves us. Whenever anything comes then that's any way challenges that system, we react like petulant children. About midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the other prisoners were listening to them. And what do you think they were thinking? What is wrong with these guys? Did the jailer beat them over the head a little too hard? Psychotic. There are probably some of them were saying, hey, shut up. Trying to sleep. You know? What's wrong with these guys? Suddenly, there was a violent earthquake, that the foundations of the prison were shaken. At once, all the prison doors flew open and everybody's chains came loose. Well, that's convenient. It's not just an earthquake, but it's one that actually helps. You know, normally earthquakes, you know, just break stuff, but this one flies open all the doors and like the chains fall off. Well, that's delightful. The jailer woke up, and when he saw the prison doors open, he drew his sword and was about to kill himself because he thought the prisoners had escaped. Why is he going to kill himself?
He'll probably get told anyways.
That's definitely part of the answer. He's probably going to be killed anyways, so might as well do it himself. You raising your hand, Colin?
Yeah. You said that the guards, if the prisoners got away, they had to take on their punishment.
Yeah. And think about how many prisoners are there. Just let that sink in for a minute. If that is true, and it is, and he looks open and all the prison doors are open, he's thinking, I'm going to be tortured in ways I can't even imagine. Because how many different people's sentences will have to come back on me? That is the most shameful way he could have possibly died, a criminal's death. And one of the ways in the ancient world that you would preserve your own honor is by taking your own life. Now, be very careful whenever you're hearing me talk about this, because I'm not promoting suicide. You hearing me? Literally, because some of you may think that this is a way in which you can preserve your honor. That's not what I'm saying. Because Jesus has a much different system than the world. We all following me? In the ancient world, though, if you wanted to preserve your honor, you could take your own life before maybe the enemies would. It's like in 73, the Jews, when they were fighting the rebellion that led to the destruction of the temple in 70. 73 is really when the battle completely stopped. And it ended at a place called Masada. Masada, you can go to Masada today, and it's this incredible fortress that even the Roman soldiers had about 9 months to a year of even trying to get into the city because it's so well fortified. There's just maze after maze after maze of just to get into the city. So at every turn, the Romans were having to fight a new battle of things falling on them or things coming at them. It was an incredibly difficult city to get into, to fight into. Finally, once the Romans pushed their way all the way in, they got inside and they found anywhere from 100 or so people, men, women, and children, all laying down, having drank poison and committed suicide, every one of them. And the reason why is because, for them, it was more honorable to take their own life than to have the pagan enemy take it for them. And one of the ways they preserved honor is by taking their own life. This may even have something to do with why Judas himself killed himself. I don't think that it was completely out of remorse. I think Judas, in a sense, was trying to preserve honor, not just for him, but for his whole group. We can get to that in Life of Christ or the Gospels if you take him with me or Mark or something. But suicide in the ancient world would have been an honorable thing. And the jailer, in this sense, would have been both preserving his own torture because of what would have happened and the honor for his family. But Paul shouted, verse 28, "Don't harm yourself, we're all here." The jailer called for lights, rushed in, and fell trembling before Paul and Silas. He then brought them out and asked, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" What just happened here? If you were going to be describing to a church what just happened here, what would you tell them? Describe these verses for me. Nothing. I wouldn't say anything. No, no answers? Seriously? Not one? Try it. Someone.
Miracle.
Okay. You would just look at him and say, miracle. That's good. Succinct. Concise. Accurate. What's the miracle, though?
Is it like a type of sin or being set free from sin?
Okay, describe it to me. I'm not against it.
Like our chains falling down and stuff.
Okay, chains falling down and stuff.
I was also thinking earlier, would the jailer be like a type of Christ, like that he was going to have to bear all the punishment? And then God intervened?
Maybe. Yeah, I'm comfortable with your allegory. Absolutely. No, that's good. What else?
Is the jailer changing allegiances?
Has
he seen the hand of God?
Yeah, what miracle? I like that too. Changing of allegiances, types of Christ.
The chains.
What miracle? Is it the chains?
Yeah.
Paul and Silas could have left. They could have escaped and gone on their way, but they stayed. And I think the jailer saw that, that because they had the Lord, they respected the authority.
Yeah, I wonder if the miracle that astounds him most is that all the prisoners are still there. And we're so obsessed with like earthquakes and all these amazing, you know, healing of people. And what really blows away the jailer is not the earthquake. It's not that the prison doors all flew open and the chains all fell off, although that's pretty cool. It's that no one left. And that's what overwhelms him. And maybe why, and the reason, well, there's several things we could possibly piece together of what's happening in this scene. Why does he come and fall down at Paul and Silas? Because maybe Paul and Silas were the ones that convinced the people not to leave. Maybe the people themselves were saying, we're going to leave. And he says, no, because then you're going to be damning this guy. We are the ones in the inner cell. We are the ones that have the most to lose here. And we're not leaving. Why would you? And they all stay. And the jailer comes back and says, who's responsible for this? Those two morons. He comes down and he falls trembling and he says, what must I do to be saved? Because, you know, that's the same question he was asking just a moment ago. And there was no answer, was there? All the doors are open, and you know the first thing he thought was, what am I going to do? What am I going to do to save my own butt? His answer was, kill myself. And now he's asking the same question to the people that actually have already saved him, physically. And I don't know if he's asking spiritually or not. But that is the answer they eventually give him. What must I do to be saved? An odd thing for a Roman to be asking a couple of Jews. Because Rome was the savior of the world. Very strange for a Roman to say, hey, what must I do to be saved? Because Rome has condemned me. Verse 31, they replied, believe in the Lord Jesus and you will be saved. You and your household. Then they spoke the word of the Lord to him and to all the others in his house. At that hour of the night, the jailer took them and unwashed their wounds. Then immediately he and all his family were baptized. The jailer brought them into his house and set a meal before them. He was filled with joy because he had come to believe in God, he and his whole family. Whenever you're a Christian and you're dedicated to carrying your cross for Christ, you will do weird things. You'll do really weird things. And that's almost what, if I was to be preaching this to a church, maybe I would even title my sermon, Become a Weirdo. Because you do weird things. Whenever you're in the inner cell of a prison, laying in your own urine, sometimes you'll even be compelled to sing, to pray, to give thanks to God for the low position that you're in. Sometimes even whenever you get a free way out of something that could bring you freedom but shame to other people, you don't take it. You take their shame upon yourself. Sometimes you'll even do weird things like whenever you convert. You may even, as a jailer, break the law by taking the prisoners out of the prison, take them to your home, feed them, wash them, and let them hang out with your family. When you become a Christian, sometimes you can just, well, you're just a weirdo. You do things that just don't look normal. But that's okay. Because it's called being a disciple of Jesus. He was a bit of a weirdo too, I think. Strange guy. Long-haired hippie that went around carrying crosses and telling other people to do the same. When it was daylight, the magistrates sent their officers to the jailer with the order, release those men. Why? Why would they want to release those men? Why release the men? This isn't released to become more punished. This is release the men. Josh, why release them?
Was the flogging illegal?
At this point, they don't know that, though, do they? That will become a major issue in a moment. But why do they want to release them now? Yeah, because in the ancient world, an earthquake was an omen. That the gods were either angry or something supernatural was happening. These men were preaching a message that God had come in the flesh with Jesus, He had resurrected, and the power that's in them it can also be used to save everyone that's hearing the message. They even display this power by casting out the demon of a girl in front of everyone. This message that is anti-Roman, however, was something they couldn't handle, so they imprisoned them. But then, at the night that they are imprisoned, a violent earthquake comes on the whole city, which almost could be, whoa, what are we being judged for? Well, what's happened in the last 24 hours? Oh no. These people speaking this message about God are now the ones that the earthquake could be directly attached to. And what these magistrates, what these city officials may be saying is, get out of here, we just need this to end. Just get out of here. Killing you, who knows what will happen to our city if we kill you. So you know what? Why don't you just be some other city's problem? Just get out of here. And instead of acquiescing, Paul decides to rub salt in the wound. He says, no, actually I'm going to make it worse for you. I love this scene. This may be one of my favorite scenes in the whole book of Acts. When it was daylight, the magistrate said, release them. Verse 36, the jailer told Paul, the magistrates have ordered that you and Silas be released. Now you can leave. Go in peace. It's good day. You've been set free. You're liberated. Rome has given you peace. Take it. Be happy. But Paul said to the officers, now wait a minute. They beat us publicly without a trial, even though we are Roman citizens, and threw us into prison. Oh, what's the problem there? What?
They didn't have a trial.
They didn't have a trial. That is a problem. What else? Roman citizens. Roman citizens were not to be publicly beaten or shamed in that manner. Because if you would shame a Roman citizen through that type of treatment, you're basically shaming the entire empire of Rome. Roman citizens had privileges that other people in the empire just simply did not have. You could not treat a Roman citizen poorly, especially beat them. If you did, you yourself could face capital punishment. Or in a Roman colony, Philippi, remember, the city itself has all of its honor and privileges because Rome gave it to him. In a Roman colony, the iron fist of Rome could come down on you pretty hard. So if you're a Roman citizen and you're beaten, the people that beat you, no matter how high they are, could suffer consequences that are way worse than a beating, but even death. Roman citizens, without a trial, thrown into prison after they were beaten, the city officials are in huge trouble. And now, do they want to get rid of us quietly? No. Let them come themselves and escort us out. I love that. He's like, you know what? I'm not leaving. Why? Because I'm a Roman citizen. And you beat me, put me without a trial, threw me in prison, and now you want to sweep me under the rug? Not happening. You want me to leave? You get the highest officials in this city to come to the inner cell and to bring me out themselves. Why is he doing that? Why is he being a jerk? Why is he acting like this? He's just sassy. Just slept on his chain wrong. What? Yeah. Because the people in the city of Philippi that have now belong to Jesus, the rest of the city, they were publicly shamed in front of everyone, were they not? Where their key leaders were beaten in front of everyone and put into prison. And now what could be accused of them whenever Paul and Silas would leave is, you are following people that are criminals. You're seditious. You're rebellious. You people are the problem of the city. And Paul says, no, actually, you're the ones that have acted inappropriately. Therefore, to not just protect themselves, but to protect the entire church. Paul says, you publicly shamed us. It's time for you to be publicly shamed. You want me to leave? Yes, please. Come get me out of the inner cell. Then everybody will see. You're darn right everybody will see. Because I'm protecting my flock. You're not going to get away with this, especially when I leave. The officers reported this to the magistrates. Oh, I'd have loved to have been there. He said no. What? He said he could leave. He said no. Why did he say no? He wants you to come and lead him out of the city. Oh my gosh. But my robe will get urine on it. I know. That's what he wants. Yeah, Brianna.
How did you get Roman citizenship? Because Saul was from Tarsus.
Uh-huh.
Like, how did he end up with that?
We find out later in Acts that Paul was born into Roman citizenship. That his parents or parent would have most likely have been a Roman citizen, and their children would have been Roman citizens as well. It was something that was inherited to you. You get honor and citizenship in one of two ways. It's either ascribed to you, you're just born into it, which is the most powerful way, the most honorable way. Or you can acquire it. And usually that has to be done kind of in an underhanded way, especially for individuals. Sometimes entire groups were granted Roman citizenship as a means of Rome. Rome would basically say this: if you guys don't cause us problems anymore, then we'll make you Roman citizens and you get all these benefits of the empire. Otherwise, you're our subjects and we will crush you. But if Rome had to crush everybody in the city, everybody in the empire, it would overwhelm them. So one of the ways that they used to keep dominance over people in the empire is they would use Roman citizenship as a weapon. As they would preserve it, make sure not many people could get it. Unless it was somebody especially close to the city of Rome itself in Italy, they would definitely offer those people Roman citizenship. And the reason why is because they were the closest ones could cause the most problem to the most vulnerable place of the whole empire. So they would say, well, we'll give you Roman benefits. You'll be Roman citizens. All the perks of us. And they're like, all right, that's good. We won't cause any problems for you. So basically what they do is they anesthetize the people. They put them to sleep. They numb them to the oppression of Rome by giving them benefits. And then people say, man, I've been given so much. Why would I ever object to Rome? And that's the way Roman citizenship could sometimes be gotten. Other times, you'd have crooked emperors or you'd have crooked magistrates, Roman officials, and people could bribe their way into it. Very rare, but it does happen at times. As a matter of fact, I believe it was Claudius's wife, which would have been around this time, was giving out Roman citizenship for a little while in exchange for sexual favors. She was a nasty woman. And eventually Claudius, I believe it was Claudius, ended up having her killed. Because you can't just keep handing out Roman citizenship flippantly. But that's how Roman citizenship was bartered. So you'll find out later whenever Paul says, I was born a Roman citizen, I believe it's Claudius Lysias says, I had to acquire mine. He either fought for it in war as a slave, and eventually after the end of 20 years or so of fighting, putting his life on the line, he achieved Roman citizenship. Or maybe he bribed his way into it. There's multiple ways you could get it, but all of them were rare. Roman citizenship was something that was both used and protected all at the same time. Yep.
When the magistrate said he released the men to the jailer, does that mean that after he took them home and like fed them and washed them, they went back to the jail?
Yeah, they had to. And the reason why is because if they didn't, then the jailer would be in some sense, he'd be violating rules. And I mean, you just can't do that. You can't take prisoners out, go feed them, hang out, and then just let them stay at your home.
So all of them did stay in the jail, like even all the other ones, two men of them.
That's what the text says. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. So the officers reported this to the magistrates. They want you to come. And when they heard that Paul and Silas were Roman citizens, they were alarmed. Alarmed is such a weak word there. They were freaked out. They were going crazy. They were in such trepidation that they didn't know how to not stop shaking. I mean, they couldn't help it. Why? Because you beat a Roman citizen. And you're not even a Roman citizen. This is a Roman colony. Roman colony does not mean that they are a part of the Roman Empire as citizens. Roman colony means they're given some benefits, but not the full benefits. But if you're a Roman colony and you beat Roman citizens, that's like declaring war on Rome. They were alarmed, you think? Verse 39, they came to appease them and escorted them from the prison, requesting them, just leave the city. We went to the inner cell, we came, we got you out, just leave the city, just get out of here, just be peaceful, be nice. And what does Paul say? After Paul and Silas came out of the prison, they went to Lydia's house and hung out for a while. I love it. He's such a punk, but I love it. Because what he's doing is he's saying, you can't shame us and get away with it when you've done wrong. We didn't do anything wrong. You're the ones that were wrong. So they say, hey, we've come to the inner cell. We're walking out. Please leave the city. And Paul says, yeah, I'll leave the city after I go hang out at Lydia's house for a while. And you know, the magistrates are all standing there outside of Lydia's house going, come on, how long is this going to take? As long as it takes. Where they met with the brothers and encouraged them. Then they left. Why did he do that? To make sure that his flock was taken care of. They experienced great shame in Philippi by having the key leaders of this movement that these people are now belong to beaten in public, imprisoned, in the inner cell. And Paul says, I'm not just bringing dignity back to myself, but I'm making sure these people are taken care of when I leave. Therefore, I will not let the magistrates just sweep this under the rug. They're not only going to have to escort me out of the city, but on the way out of the city, I'm going to hang out a couple hours in Lydia's house and encourage the believers while all the magistrates are sitting there looking inside waiting for them to leave. Then they left. Notice, though, a shift. What do you notice? They left. What does that say? Luke stayed in Philippi. And this is something that consistently happens throughout Paul's ministry. He will pick up a couple people from a city and he'll leave one or two. Pick up a couple people, leave one or two. It's a way of making sure that the people that have been traveling with him, getting one-on-one tutelage, are actually able to impart that knowledge and wisdom onto the other people at the other cities. So he'll take a couple people with him, let them travel with him, and I'm sure as they're walking, they're dialoguing, he's talking to them about Jesus, he's talking to them about the Old Testament, he's talking to them about the ways in which you evangelize and the different passages to go to. And once he gets to the next city, he looks at him and he says, now you're ready, you stay and encourage these believers. And this is Luke's turn. Because Luke came from what city? Troas. We pick up Luke in Troas, and now he's going to hang out in Philippi for a while. Chapter 17, verse 1. When they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a Jewish synagogue. Why do we not get a description of the ministry in Amphipolis or Apollonia? Why?
Were they theologically not as important?
Maybe theologically they're not as important? Possibly. Why would they theologically not be as important? I'm not saying I disagree.
Maybe there wasn't a Jewish synagogue there.
There wasn't a Jewish synagogue in Philippi, though, either.
Well, if Luke stayed, then he wouldn't have been there to dictate if he's writing the first-hand account.
But, yeah, that's possible. But other places throughout Acts, Luke hasn't been there, and we've got the full account as well. In the book of Acts, your city is only important if there's a church there. Does that make sense? Your city is only important to discuss in the book of Acts, to spend time dialoguing about it, describing the ministry, if there's a church there. More than likely, the reason why Amphipolis and Apollonia are not talked about is because no churches were planted. Therefore, moving on to Thessalonica. Notice, too, we're on something called the Via Ignatia, or the Ignatian Way. The red line on the map here is the Via Ignatia. And you can see where it stretches. This is all across Macedonia. Let me flip back to the other map. You see where Bithynia is, and you see where Macedonia ends over here. Top of Bithynia all the way over to Macedonia. Now, that's what we're going to zoom in on when we look at the Via Ignatia. See how far it stretches? Over 100 miles, this thing is stretching. Actually, a couple hundred miles. But you see, that's what they're walking along. And you see Amphipolis is right there in the middle. And they just come from Philippi. They've passed Apollonia, which isn't on this map. But now they're in Thessaloniki, which is on this map, or Thessalonica, the way we pronounce it. And that's where they're at right now. That'll become significant in just a moment of what happens once they get sent off to Berea. But we're on the Via Ignatia, very important Roman road. The Via Ignatia was originally created so that the Roman soldiers could go across the empire in a quicker manner to get to the different war zones they needed to get to. And I find it very appropriate that now it's being used for the army of God to spread the message of true peace through Jesus walking along the same Via Ignatia. There was a Jewish synagogue. Why is that significant? What does that tell me?
In
tells me that there's at least 10 Jewish males inside that city, at least 10 Jewish families, which contrasts what we found in Philippi, because there wasn't one there. As his custom was, Paul went to the synagogue, and on three Sabbath days, he reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and proving that the Christ had to suffer and rise from the dead. Notice, not only is the custom Paul going to the synagogues, but it's also the message. You can pretty much predict what he'd be preaching. He's going to probably give a history of Israel, showing how Jesus fits into that history, particularly the resurrection. And number three, going to Old Testament texts to show that this was already been talked about. Where do I get that from? That three-pronged sermon. What's that? Yeah, we have Stephen's speech. We have Peter's at Pentecost. Every sermon that's been preached has those three elements, doesn't it? More than likely, that's what he's doing here as well. This Jesus I'm proclaiming to you is the Christ, the King. The Christ, the King, he said. Some of the Jews were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, as did a large number of God-fearing Greeks, naturally, because it's a Gentile inclusion message, and not a few prominent women. Remember, in Macedonia, in the region that we're in, women had opportunities they just didn't in other regions. And if not a few prominent women says that, like Lydia, we have some major female converts that will probably be major players in this city as well. But the Jews were jealous. Why were the Jews jealous? Because they always are, is that what somebody said? Yeah. They're just naturally jealous people.
Up to this point, they were the only ones that had the connection to God.
Yeah, maybe up to, it's because maybe they're trying to protect their own position of prominence within the story of God. We are the ones. Maybe they're jealous because now Gentiles are being allowed in. Maybe they're jealous because they've come into their home turf, synagogues, preached a message saying that the people of God are now found through Jesus, which takes away their positions of power and prominence a little bit. Does it not? Anytime, remember I told our definition of conflict, anytime you have two people or two kingdoms trying to occupy the same space at the same time, both geographically or theologically, you're going to have conflict. You're going to have conflict, and that's what's happening here. But the Jews were jealous, so they rounded up some bad characters from the marketplace, formed a mob, and started a riot in the city. Why would they start a riot? How does that, why is that the response? Oh man, they're ticking me off. You know what we should do? Let's get a bunch of people together and just start rioting. Why would we do that?
They maybe want to stir up everyone else, like get everyone else angry.
Yeah, but why? Absolutely, they did.
They wanted them out.
Who? Paul and Silas?
Yeah.
Why? How would a riot accomplish that? Yes. Because Rome wants peace. See, remember we talked about just a minute ago. Well, 35 minutes ago. That the people in the ancient world, even if they were upset with someone, they couldn't beat them or kill them themselves. They had to have the right authorities doing it. And the Jews are ticked off at these stinking Christians. But they themselves can't punish them. But if they start a riot, blame it on the Christians, now they've got the right authorities involved. Because Rome doesn't care so much about the religious squabbles of the Jews, because they're always having them. But they do care. They really care about peace in a city. So the Jews say, let's start a riot and blame it on them. So they start a riot. They rush to Jason's house in search of Paul and Silas in order to bring them out to the crowd. But when they did not find them, they dragged Jason and some other brothers before the city officials, shouting, "These men who have caused trouble all over the world have now come here, have caused trouble all over the world, have broken the Roman peace, the Pax Romana, everywhere. And now they're here, breaking the peace even in our city." Now notice the next accusation. And now come here, and Jason's welcomed them into his house. They are all defying Caesar's decrees, saying that there is another king, one called Jesus. You could not have a more serious accusation leveled against you in the ancient world. He's defying the decrees of Caesar, saying there's another king. His name is Jesus. Here's my question, though. Were the Christians guilty? Yeah. They were. Because they were calling for another king and another kingdom, were they not? What did he say in their synagogues? This Jesus is the King, the Christ, the King of the kingdom. And the Jews start a riot, and the city officials come in, they say, what's going on here? These people who've caused problems all over the world are now causing problems here. How so? They're claiming there's another king. And they're asking people to pledge their allegiance to him. That'll get Rome's attention. Even if you're a Roman citizen, you can be punished for that. That's called subversion, or sedition, or a revolution, or an uprising. And technically, the Christians were guilty of it. Because they did call Jesus another king, and another kingdom. And so Rome's going to have to deal with it. Matter of fact, this is the accusation that really even the Jews brought against Pontius Pilate and John. John's gospel, right? If you don't kill Jesus, you are no friend of Caesar, the Jews said to Pontius Pilate. Same idea. If you really claim to be aligned, the allegiance with Rome, you can't be letting a guy run around saying there's another king, another kingdom. That's exactly what Paul and them were describing. So they were guilty. When they heard this, the crowd and the city officials were thrown into turmoil. Then they made Jason and the others post bond and let them go. Why? Why would they let them go? That's a pretty big accusation. Why let them go? Why let them post bond? Couple of things. Number one, posting bonds a little bit different in their world than ours. More than likely, there may have been some sort of financial something, but there was also an agreement in place, more than likely, between Jason and the city officials that he would take care of the situation once he was let go. That he would maybe kick Paul and Silas out. Or maybe he even agreed, I'll turn Paul and Silas over to you. Maybe it's possible that he even lied in order to get out to set Paul and Silas free. So they let them go. Go take care of the situation. As soon as it was night, the brothers sent Paul and Silas away to Berea. Notice what they do there. Smuggle them out. But the fact they send them to Berea is very significant. Because look at our handy dandy map. Where is Berea? Exactly. It's not on the Via Ignatia. It's a small little rinky-dink city off the beaten path that if you're a fugitive and you're trying to hide from the law, be a smart place to go. And we'll pick them up there tomorrow. Love you guys. See you then.